We're back with this extended edition of Clear Path, your roadmap to health and wealth, brought to you by the Transamerica Institute. And we're taking a very good look at a new study that was produced by the Transamerica Center for Health Studies and the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg Center for Public Health. We have here at the studios of WYPR Dr. Ron Getzel, a leading authority on these issues for some 30-plus years. You don't look it. And so you're doing all the right things. And Hector De La Torre, who, of course, leads the Transamerica Center for Health Studies. Dr. Getzel, when we think about wellness, workplace wellness programs, I mean, you tend to think of yoga classes down in an empty office or conference room and walking clubs and maybe those who are trying to quit smoking, a support group. But it's more than that, isn't it? What you're looking at and what this study looks at, it's got to translate into much more than just supporting workers to do healthy things.
Right. So all the things you said, Greg, are absolute ingredients or components of a good program, but they're kind of random acts of wellness. What you want to do is tie them all together and put together what's referred to as a comprehensive health promotion program with a strategy, with a lot of organizational support. And essentially, these programs can't just be in isolation where people go, you know, their own time in the back alley and so forth. They've got to be part of what the organization is about, its mission, its vision, and a lot of organizational support from senior and middle managers. So this has got to be a lot about who they are, and they've got to establish a culture of wealth, of health and wealth, in which these programs are embedded.
Have you gotten feedback from many of these employers that, you know, come on, I'm trying to run a business here. I've got to make certain sales objectives, or I got to get this done. I got to get this out the door. In the end, mm-hmm. people are there to presumably stay in business and make a profit. And now there's this layer of expectation of implementing programs and as you say, creating this culture of wellness and sort of healthy lifestyle incentives. How do you strike a balance so that it's...
Well, to do all the things you just described, you need people. You need people who are focused, they're energized, they're healthy, they're not out sick, they're motivated, they see a purpose in their being there at the business because they like what their employer is doing on their behalf, and they want to support the employer in doing good work and being a good, profitable business. In fact, we just published a study last month in the Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine. We looked at winners of the C. Everett Koop Award, which is an award that's given out every year to companies that can document that their programs have improved health and save money. And we retrospectively invested $10,000 in a portfolio of those 26 companies that have won the award over the last 15 years versus the S&P 500. They outperformed the S&P 500 significantly. Wow. You would have made a lot more money had you bought stock in those 26 companies versus invested in the S&P 500. So they're doing something right for their workers, but they're also doing something right for their business.
Well, that's exactly where I was going to go next, is how do you really quantify this and measure it in terms of dollars and cents? And it sounds like you can and you have.
Well, this is one example. But when we go into individual companies, we do look at their healthcare cost trends, their absenteeism, their disability, their safety and workers' comp incidents, and their productivity and performance metrics. So there are all these things you can measure, but they have to align with health improvement. This is not just a cost-cutting venture. It's a way of improving health. And if you improve health and well-being, you can also see financial impacts.
Dr. Getzel, you've talked about the difference between return on investment and the value of investment. What is the difference and how does it apply to workplace wellness?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, return on investment is an economic term. It's a cost-benefit analysis. Basically, I spend $1. How many dollars do I get back for that investment? It's a straight financial calculation. And there are a lot of studies, and we've conducted a lot of studies that have looked at that with Citibank, with Highmark, with Johnson & Johnson and other companies, where we've published findings showing a positive return on investment from these programs. But what Hector is referring to is value. So value means things like, do you keep people motivated? Are they performing at a high value? Do they like the employer? Are they loyal? Is there a social connectedness at the workplace? They like going to work in the morning. Those are the things that are often intangible. You can't put a dollar sign next to.
Hector highlighted earlier, you know, there are laws on the books governing these sort of workplace practices, and you really can't discriminate, or you can't hold it against it. There can't be any negative mm-hmm. Repercussions for those who don't participate. However, there's an incentive if they do under the Affordable Care Act. So let's look at that briefly. Do you see is there any feedback or any analysis about, in some respects, it does create factions within the workplace? In other words, those who are with the program, as it were, and out there strapping on their running shoes and walking during lunchtime and doing whatever else is part of a workplace wellness program, and those who, for whatever reason, perhaps their physical condition, perhaps mm-hmm. it's a disability, perhaps it's just that's not their thing. You know, they want to come to work. I'm paid to come to work. I want my paycheck. I give everything. And now you expect me to do calisthenics, you know.
Well, written into the law, there's something called the reasonable alternative standard, which Hector referred to, meaning that if you're disabled and you can't run a mile, there are other ways in which you can satisfy certain requirements, let's say, or certain conditions of health promotion. One example that's an obvious example, let's say you're a smoker and you can't quit smoking. The reasonable alternative standard means that you participate in a smoking cessation class. Even if you don't quit smoking, you still get the credit. You still get the discount on the insurance.
Let's talk briefly about the issue of smoking at the workplace. We all see, if you're here in Baltimore and you're driving by, you see groups huddled together in the harsh winter months, puffing away outside. Some employers have banned smoking altogether. I think we were talking earlier, Hector and I, the Cleveland Clinic. Yeah, that's part of your employment conditions. You cannot be a smoker, and they're not going to hire you if you are. What's the trend there? Is this an issue of discrimination, or is this the employer's right to say, no, you may have smoked since you were 15, but you're not going to smoke at the office?
Well, smoking, I think, is one of the great public health successes. If you go back to the 1960s, close to 50% of the population was smoking. And today it's fewer than 20% of the population smoking. And that's not just because people all of a sudden don't like smoking. It's because we put policies in place and programs and actually made it the non-norm, something you should not be doing in your workplace or even in a family setting. It's cut back on smoking, and what's really important is that most of the smokers actually want to quit smoking. They get a lot of feedback from their friends, neighbors, and family members saying, you know, why are you smoking? It's a bad habit. It's going to kill you eventually, and it's very expensive. And so most smokers do want to quit smoking. They're just looking for tools and resources to do it, and if the employer can help them do that, facilitate that, all the better.
And you gave the example of the Cleveland Clinic. Yes, they basically over time eliminated any employees who were smoking. If you would get a warning if you were caught smoking the first time, and then you'd get fired if you were smoking the second time, if you were caught smoking anywhere around that campus. Clearly, the Cleveland Clinic is a health facility, and so they were trying to set the example. So they didn't just stay there. They provided smoking cessation. Anything related to smoking cessation was free to the employee. So they really put their money where their mouth was. And then they led an anti-smoking effort in the whole county region around Cleveland. So they really made a big push for it. They're known for it. And so for them to say, we're not going to hire you if you smoke, really was consistent with the culture of that company.
Let's turn now to the issue of health risk factors, both in terms of the individual, meaning the employee, and how they may be defined in relation to the actual employer.
Yeah, so I think that's an important distinction that you're making. You need to address health risk factors and also protective factors at both the individual level but also the organizational level. So you can't just walk in and say, I want all my employees to be healthy. Go ahead, be healthy, and that's, you know, it's your job, not my job. The organization has to support that kind of environment. A culture of health is what we call it. So the traditional risk factors that we talk about at the individual level are things that are, you know, quite deadly in American society. Obesity, tobacco use, hypertension, high blood cholesterol, but also the psychosocial risk factors like depression and high stress. But then you've got to also consider, what does the employer do to create a supportive, healthy environment versus a toxic environment? I mean, when you go to work every day, think of yourself. You want to get up in the morning and say, boy, am I looking forward to going to work because I enjoy my job. I enjoy my coworkers. My employer gives me flexibility. I can exercise during the day. I have a whole lot of things that I can do to improve my health and well-being. In fact, my employer wants me to be healthy so that I can be productive. I can help in the organizational mission. Imagine that kind of mindset as opposed to, I got to go to work and I'm going to be stressed out and I'm going to be surrounded by vending machines with fatty foods and no breaks there and people smoking outside the door. It's a very different environment. So that's why you've got to create a culture that supports a healthy lifestyle.
That culture is driven by one person at the top, mm-hmm. a CEO. I know at Safeway grocery stores, the CEO there was very much into workplace wellness. We have in our study a series of interviews. The CEO of a credit union was the one who really wanted to do this because he personally was doing it. And so he felt that others should try it as well. And so he kind of changed the organization. But that's just one person in a whole company. So you need to have other people. Dr. Getzel mentioned it earlier, at high management and middle management, all buying into this and promoting it and being supportive of it. Because you can't have the CEO saying, this is what we're going to do, and then a line manager telling employees, you can't go for extra 15 minutes right at lunch to go walk around.
Well, it occurred to me, if this were a call-in show, I could envision a call from somebody saying, my friends and I or my colleagues and I want to go walk every hour. We want to be able to get up and go outside for a brisk 10-minute walk, and our employer just won't allow that. So if you don't have that support, if the guy or the woman at the top isn't supportive of workplace wellness, then what?
Well, I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head there. That's why you get some employees who are very loyal to their employer, and they are glad to be there because their employer cares about their health and well-being, and their fellow workers are supporting a healthy lifestyle, versus employees who are kind of feeling, I'm going to work because I have to go to work, but I'm not that engaged, and, if I can find another job that really cares about me, I'm more likely to go work there. Which is why a lot of employers are now beginning to see this as part of who they are and part of what they need to do in order to succeed in business, but not because it's, the latest fad, but because it really does change your mindset and your purpose of the organization and brings along other people with that mindset.
So it's essential, it's as essential to their competitiveness and their success as marketing and cost and whatever other metrics they use to advance their competitiveness and win in the marketplace.
Well, and if those line managers are seeing the benefit of their team showing up to work on a more regular basis, then there is value to them. There was a Harvard metadata analysis where they looked at some of these issues of return on investment, value of investment. And one of the things that really came out in that study was that attendance by employees at companies that had workplace wellness was significantly higher. And just them showing up and not having to worry about backfilling is an incredible improvement for the workplace.
One of the key risk factors that have been identified in the study between the Transamerica Center for Health Studies and Johns Hopkins is stress management. Stress. Now, that's the most obvious risk factor I can think of in a job setting. How do you really address that in a meaningful way? Because business is business, and pressures aren't going to lessen. They're potentially increase. So
there are a lot of factors that go into creating stress. Something called decision latitude, which means involving workers in making decisions about how work is done. If they have a role in it, if they can manage the workflow, and they're given flexibility in getting things done with their fellow workers, that lessens their stress tremendously. If they've got a supportive supervisor, a non-toxic supervisor, somebody who's there on their side, who's a colleague, who's giving them advice and support and mentorship, and the goals are reasonable. In other words, I need you to get this done at a reasonable time. Can you do it? Yes, let's work together. So there are many organizational factors that contribute to stress. And it's not just important to teach people how to manage stress, but also how does the organization manage the workflow and the environment as a whole that may induce stress.
One of the other risk factors that you highlighted was sleep hygiene, as you call it. And that's just about getting a good night's rest. And we've all seen the colleague, or we know ourselves, showing up at the office with too little sleep or perhaps an ill-timed night out the evening before. What does the employer have to do with that?
Well, you can give tips to people in terms of, you know, how to get a good night's sleep. You know, there are certain patterns. In other words, you go to bed at a certain time. You don't have devices next to you. You're not working till late at night. You get a reasonable amount of hours. You don't, you know, you exercise earlier in the day. You don't eat big meals. So these are the kinds of tips that help people get a good night's sleep. But, you know, basically emphasizing your workday is from, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever the right time is. I had a boss who walked around one day when we were in the office. It was 6 in the afternoon, in the evening. And he said, everybody go home. Come on. Work is over. It's done. Go home. Spend time with your family. Get a good night's rest. So it's that kind of feedback that really does motivate people to have good habits.
Very interesting. We'll continue this discussion, of course, on workplace wellness here on this extended edition of ClearPath, your roadmap to health and wealth, brought to you by the Transamerica Institute. We'll be right back.